This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. As protests continue and federal and state lawmakers continue to draft proposals to combat the overuse of force, particularly against African Americans, two Democratic lawmakers have called for California's Attorney General to investigate the fatal shooting of a young man by a Los Angeles County Sheriff's deputy. In a statement, the two lawmakers say that there's a need for independent investigation into the death of 18-year-old Andreas Guardado, so the public will trust the findings. Messages seeking comment were sent to the Attorney General's office and the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department. Guardado was shot Thursday after Los Angeles County Sheriff's deputies spotted him with a gun in front of a business near Gardena. Several hundred people gathered Sunday to protest the shooting. A New York City police officer has now been suspended without pay after he was recorded putting his arm around a man's neck in what the police commissioner called an apparent chokehold. The department's action to suspend the officer was stunning in its swiftness, occurring just hours after the morning confrontation on a beach boardwalk in the Rockaway section of Queens, New York. The American Museum of Natural History is removing a statue of Theodore Roosevelt, the president, on horseback with a Native American man and an African man on his sides after objections that it symbolizes colonial expansion and racial discrimination. Mayor Bill de Blasio said that the city supports removal of the statue because it depicts black and indigenous people as subjugated and racially inferior. The museum's president tells the New York Times the decision to remove the bronze statue comes amid the movement for racial justice following the killing of George Floyd, the African-American man whose death while in police custody sparked international protests that continue to this day. More at voanews.com. Again, voanews.com. This is VOA News. The COVID-19 pandemic continues to accelerate globally, with the World Health Organization reporting a record increase in global coronavirus cases Sunday. The global death toll approaches 468,000, and it's approximately 120,000 in the U.S., where some health experts are warning of what they call a second wave of COVID-19 this fall. Others say that the United States and some other parts of the world are not over the first wave. The number of confirmed global infections quickly approaches the milestone of 9 million. It's more than 2.2 million in the U.S. Brazil, the world's number two coronavirus hotspot after the United States, officially passed 50,000 coronavirus deaths Sunday. It's a blow for a country already grappling with more than 1 million cases, rising political instability and a crippled economy. Experts say the true numbers are higher because of a lack of widespread testing. In China, Beijing is banning imports from the top U.S. poultry producer Tyson Foods after an outbreak of the virus in one of its plants. China is also ordering a Beijing Pepsi factory to close as authorities race to contain a new cluster in the capital. Health officials report 22 new cases in Beijing from an outbreak linked to a wholesale market. Passengers are donning masks as they arrive at Madrid's main airport now that Spain has opened its borders to most European countries and ended a state of emergency Sunday. Spain's borders are not open to Portugal, the Schengen area, members outside the bloc in Britain. All arriving passengers will have their temperatures taken, submit information about where they came from, and provide their location in Spain in case they need to be traced. Spain's border with Portugal is supposed to reopen on July 1st. New York City's effort to stop the spread of the coronavirus through contact tracing has been hampered by the reluctance of some people with the virus to provide information to tracers. The New York Times reports that only 35% of the city residents who tested positive or were presumed positive for COVID-19 in the first 2 weeks of the contact tracing program gave information about their close contacts. The dean of the public health at Rutgers University tells the New York Times that the 35% rate for elite contacts is very bad. And Dr. Ted Long, head of the New York City's new test and trace corps, defended the program Sunday and said 69% of the people who complete an interview provide contacts. The head of the U.S. House Judiciary Committee, Gerald Nadler, is saying that while U.S. Attorney General William Barr deserves to be impeached over the firing of a federal prosecutor whose office had investigated President Trump's lawyer, that the effort would be a waste of time. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voices of America. I'm James Mbate in Washington. Today is Monday, June 22nd, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Malawians are voting tomorrow, Tuesday, in a court-ordered presidential election.
Given the level of goodwill in the electorates, and also given the amount of work we have put into this, we believe that we have the capacity to deliver a credible electoral event.
A Malian opposition member says no to ECOWAS request for a rerun of the March parliamentary election. Activists welcome a Ugandan court ruling allowing prisoners in the diaspora to vote in the 2021 general election. And the African Union suspends South Sudan's voting rights for not meeting its financial obligations.
For those of us who are watchers of South Sudan for a while now, it is not surprising. Right now, as we speak, even in South Sudan, public servants have not been paid for 5 months.
Brian Adeba is the Deputy Director of Policy at the Enough Project. And this morning, a tribute to a fallen Cameroon journalism icon. Those stories plus Samson Omale's sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The chair of Malawi's newly constituted electoral commission says his commission is ready to preside over a free and credible presidential election tomorrow, Tuesday. Chifundo Kashale says the commission has taken care of most of the logistics. The country's constitutional court mandated the fresh election in February this year after invalidating the 2019 presidential election due to irregularities. The much-talked-about elections have been marred by legal wrangling and protests, resulting in the resignation of former Electoral Commission Chair Jean Ansa and the subsequent reconstitution of the commission. Chifundo Kashale is the new chair of the Malawi Electoral Commission.
All the logistics that are within our control, we've managed to remedy those gaps. For example, we've had to hire trucks and station wagons to fill in the gap of the request we made to government. UNDP has also come in with some support to fill the gap. So far as the funding is concerned, about 35% of the funds that were appropriated by Parliament are yet to come in. But we've continued to proceed with the assurance that all the resources we need in order to administer this event will be made available as mandated by the appropriate authorities.
Just last week, you hinted at a possible delay of the elections due to logistics. Has your commission been able to sort out the logistics problems?
As we speak, we have managed to distribute all the polling materials to the various polling centers. And indeed, over the past few weeks, we've managed to train the various cadres of polling staff. We've also deployed the strongest security detail to secure the peace and provide for the security of the vote. So we believe that in the circumstances, we have managed to do what we need to do to be prepared.
There were concerns that Malawians who registered in the 2019 election may not be able to vote in tomorrow's election. Who is eligible to vote in tomorrow's election?
In its decision on the 8th of May 2020, the Supreme Court of Appeal made it very clear about who is eligible to vote. Everyone who registered for the 2019 tripartite election, whether or not they went to vote, are eligible to vote. We are not going to allow any new voters who registered after the event in 2019 to participate in this election.
Of course, this election is taking place amid the coronavirus pandemic. What measures do you have in place to keep the voters safe?
We have trained ushers at the polling centers to manage social distancing as the voters are coming to vote. All our staff who have personal protection equipment, they'll be wearing masks, and there's also provision for soap and water to wash hands as everybody is coming to cast their votes. And obviously, for issues of compliance with COVID measures, we'd be pleading to all the voters and other stakeholders around the polling centers to ensure that they are also acting in a manner that reflects that we have a public health crisis and therefore maintain and comply.
Because of what happened with the 2019 presidential election and the subsequent court rulings and the selection of a brand new elections commission, what are your biggest fears for tomorrow's election?
Our commission is proceeding with a lot of hope, given the level of goodwill in the electorates and also given the amount of work we have put into this and the team that's on the ground have invested in this. We believe that we have the capacity to deliver a credible electoral event. So we are proceeding with confidence and hope trusting that there's grace to deliver something that will inspire confidence in the people of Malawi.
Chifundo Kashale is the chairperson of Malawi's Reconstituted Election Commission. He was speaking with us from the capital, Lilongwe. A Malian opposition member says the opposition will settle for nothing short of the resignation of President Ibrahim Boubacar Keïta. The Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, over the weekend called for a rerun of the March parliamentary elections and the formation of a government of national unity. Yes, Samake was a first-round candidate for Mali's largest electoral district of Kati. He says the opposition welcomes ECOWAS intervention, but President Keïta is no longer capable of leading Mali.
The African Union and the ECOWAS leadership coming to Mali because the situation is clearly out of the control of her current president, Ibrahim Boubacar Keïta. Of course, we appreciate the mediation, but we have come to the conclusion that this is not enough. It is not enough to postpone or to redo the elections. We are in face of a government that is incapable of being just, incapable of providing social justice. The government that's incapable of leading the current president due to his 75 years old and chronic illness is no longer fit for office. Is come to the point that people of Mali have come together, opposition groups, to request that the president resign. And that is our final demand. We are not going to do any partial fixes, put bandages on the wound, and we would not do that anymore. I think that we have the people ready for the change. And it has to be known that the number one institution of any country and the most permanent institution of any country is people. If we the people demand that this president steps down, he has abused his power, he is no longer fit for office, and he was not able to keep his promises. People of Mali, I'm talking about promise for social justice, for security, for stability of the country, but for good governance.
If having a rerun is out of the question and the opposition feels that the president should step down, how do you intend to carry that out? Would this mean more protests?
Absolutely. You've seen the Arab Springs. This is the time for Mali Spring. You've seen what happened in Sudan. You've seen what happened in Algeria. We don't have to be violent. We, the people, are the first institution of this country. We only delegated our power to institutions like a presidency or parliament. But if they do not solve our problem, if they don't listen to the people, we have all the right to demand that they step down.
Yes, Samake was a first-round parliamentary candidate for Mali's largest electoral district of Kati. He was speaking with us from the capital, Bamako. Activists in Uganda have welcomed a court ruling instructing the Uganda Electoral Commission to allow prisoners and Ugandans living in the diaspora to vote in the 2021 general election. The High Court said it was illegal for these two categories of Ugandans to be denied their right to participate in elections that affect their lives. Mugumi Davis Rakarinji reports from Kampala.
The High Court ruling issued last Friday directs Uganda's Electoral Commission to ensure that all Uganda citizens of 18 years and above register and exercise their right to vote as per Article 59 of the Ugandan Constitution. Human rights lawyer Stephen Kalali, who petitioned the High Court in 2018, welcomed the court ruling.
I was very happy because, you know, this was a political milestone case. They had left them out without any justification because we don't have any law or statutory instrument that bars any citizen from voting, despite having committed any crime or being abroad, you don't lose your citizenship.
Kalali says it's important prisoners, as well as Ugandans living abroad, to vote for their leaders because they equally participate in national development, either directly or indirectly. Another activist and lawyer, Isaac Semakade, agrees. In fact, he says the ruling was long overdue.
Prison conditions, for instance, are matters in which prisoners must have a say, and the national elections are an opportunity for them to be heard as prisoners, and the important remittances that we receive from Ugandan diaspora to support our budget and household income, they make important contributions to national development.
And some Ugandans living abroad are excited about the court pronouncement.
My name is Esther Mwambi. I am a Ugandan based in Netherlands. And this is very exciting news, although I don't think that we were supposed to first petition something like this in order for us to be able to vote, because this is a fundamental right for every Ugandan and is clearly stated in our constitution.
My name is Helen Baluka, a Ugandan citizen living in the Netherlands. It feels really empowering to know that I can still have a voice even though I live abroad, because the decisions made in Uganda still affect us as people who live in the diaspora.
Hamid Lugolobi, the Electoral Commission lawyer, says the commission is still studying the court's decision.
We actually recognize that right under Article that one, that, but our argument and defense in that case was that there is no legal framework. That actually has been our defense and argument. But I think next week the commission will have to sit and take a position on it.
Neighbors Rwanda and Kenya already allow their nationals living abroad to cast their votes through their respective embassies. Other African countries such as South Africa, Ghana, Nigeria and Zambia also allow prisoners and their nationals living in foreign countries to vote. For VOA News, Aya Mugume, Davis Rwakarinji in Kampala, Uganda.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butter in Washington. Today is Monday, June 22nd. The African Union has suspended South Sudan's voting rights due to lack of payment of its financial contributions. In a June 17 memo to the South Sudan Undersecretary for Foreign Affairs, the South Sudan Embassy in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia, informed the government in Juba that South Sudan had been sanctioned by the AU for failing to meet its financial obligation of $9,191,000. As a result, South Sudan was prevented from participating in the African Union meeting of June 16. VOA reached South Sudan Information Minister Michael Makui, who said he did not know about the suspension because he had been ill from COVID-19. But Brian Adeba, Deputy Director of Policy at the Enough Project, says he's not surprised.
For those of us who are watchers of South Sudan for a while now, it is not surprising. South Sudan is generally in arrears with regard to its financial obligations, both on the local front and also internationally. Right now, as we speak, even in South Sudan, public servants have not been paid for 5 months. So this is not an entirely surprising thing. It's a recurring theme in South Sudan.
For the ordinary South Sudanese, I'm sure they are wondering, how could this be possible about a country, their country, that produces oil, is an oil-producing country?
Oh, yes. There are millions of dollars that are reaped from oil sold abroad. The egregious corruption in the country that has allowed public officials to dip their hands into public coffers and steal public money, use public money for their own personal use, and therefore creating a deficit in terms of payments for salaries for local employees of the government, the civil service, and also defaults on international obligations to organizations such as the African Union, the OEU, and IGAD, and others. So this is not a surprising thing. We're talking of a very corrupt system here, where public officials have free rein of public coffers. Institutions that are supposed to offer oversight, generally of financial management, these institutions have been stymied, detoothed, and made unable to do their work.
How much do you know about what's happening now in terms of where South Sudan is on the peace process? Could this all be part of what's happening?
Well, the peace process got off on a very shaky start. It's wobbling along right now. I would say it's in a much better place than it was at the beginning of the year. You have a government of national unity formed. That's positive. The parties to the conflict have agreed on the formation of allocation of the states, who is to take what state. I think that's positive. However, significant shortfalls remain in implementing the security arrangements. And it also all boils down to lack of resources. One of the reasons is the egregious corruption that we're talking about. Right now, cantonment is in trouble. The creation of a unified force is in trouble. A whole set of security arrangements that are supposed to be implemented under the terms of the agreement are in trouble because of lack of resources.
Brian Adeba is the Deputy Director of Policy at the Enough Project. You are speaking with us from Washington. Despite the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic, a bauxite company known by its French acronym CGB relocated an entire village in the Boké region of Guinea to an incomplete resettlement that was lacking adequate housing, water, and sanitation, according to a new joint report by a variety of international organizations, including U.S.-based Inclusive Development International. David Prey, Executive Director of IDI, spoke to Ricky Stryak about the negative impact bauxite mining is having on communities in Guinea.
Well, the whole country was under lockdown orders. CBG, which is a joint venture of multinational mining giants Alcoa and Rio Tinto, decided that this would be a good time to relocate a 200-year-old village so that they could expand their mine. And the company moved around 100 families to an unfinished resettlement site without adequate housing, water and sanitation, and without arable land and livelihood opportunities.
Besides the fact that they moved a population during a pandemic, you know, what other kind of negative impacts, and I think that's putting it lightly, does this have on the communities?
There are at least a dozen other villages that have been affected by the mine, and many more that stand to be affected as the mine expands. This is really an entire population, a region, the Boké region of Guinea, that are in target of bauxite mining. And this population affected by the CBG company has seen their ancestral lands, their water, their forests, and their livelihoods eroded steadily by CBG over the last 30 years that it's been mining in their area. And what's happening now is that mining is intensifying across the Boké region. CBG is expanding. There are many other bauxite mining operations that have been granted concessions. The whole area has just been carved up and handed over to mining companies. And this is the part of Guinea which is also the breadbasket of the country. It's the most fertile agricultural land. And so this mining intensification has been causing cumulative environmental and social impacts that have been really unbearable for local communities.
What's the way forward?
Hamdalai and 12 other villages filed a formal complaint with the IFC's ombudsman in February of last year with a view to sitting down with CBG in a facilitated mediation process to negotiate redress, to negotiate remedial action, and ideally to change the way this company and other mining companies in Boké are operating so that they start mining bauxite much more responsibly, which is entirely possible to do. It's impossible to, rather than take people's land without providing compensation, which has been the modus operandi of CBG and other bauxite companies in Guinea, but rather to lease the land, to rehabilitate the land, and to share the benefits in a meaningful way with the landowners, and that means paying them, you know, a considerable sum of money for the use of their land. It means rehabilitating the land by preserving the topsoil and providing them with replacement farmland while they're operating, and then enabling people to return to their farmlands.
That was David Prigg, Executive Director of Inclusive Development International. He was speaking to Ricky Stryak from North Carolina. Cameroon is mourning the sudden death of a journalism icon, Chief Fouanyi Nkemenya Paul, who passed away last Thursday, June 18. He was 61. Chief Nkemenya Paul was the vice president of the Commonwealth Journalists Association and also publisher and managing editor of the Sun newspaper in Cameroon's English-speaking Southwest region. Solomon Aborim is the editor of the Star newspaper.
Chief Fouanyi Nkemenya Paul, the icon of journalism in this country, he will be remembered for his quest to defend the truth at all cost, for his quest to protect the downtrodden, for his quest to seek for freedom of expression in this country, Chief Wanyi was one of those that your problem is his problem, and the problem of journalists becomes his problem immediately. And these are the key things that they will be remembered, and particularly for me, I will remember him at all times to be a generous man, because he will share even the little he's got with everyone to ensure that you don't meet him and go back the same. This is the kind of individual we've lost in this country.
Solomon Aboren is the editor of the Star newspaper of Cameroon. He was speaking with us from Limbe in Cameroon's English-speaking Southwest region. For Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Monday morning to you, Samson.
Good Monday morning to you too, James. We begin the sports in Egypt, where the North African country is asking all players and club staff to undergo polymerase chain reaction tests to ascertain their COVID-19 status with effect from Sunday. Egyptian football has been halted since the 14th of March as the total number of COVID-19 cases reached more than 50,000 cases. The EFA had stressed that all players must take the PCR test twice, with at least 5 days separating each test, while also explaining that positive results will be disclosed privately in order to respect the player's privacy. And now to South Africa, where the South Africa Football Association has removed two vice presidents following a national executive committee meeting on Saturday. Ria Lidwaba and Game Wekwena were the two individuals relieved of their duties after the NEC said they had no more confidence in their abilities. Acting Chief Executive Officer Tibogo Motlanthe says Lidwaba's removal is related to her sending a letter to the South African Sports Confederation and Olympic Committee and the Sports Minister Nathi Mthuthuwa, asking for intervention on internal matters.
The constitution and that of FIFA is clear on third-party involvement, and she could have looked for other avenues like talking to CAF or FIFA if she felt that the association is not doing right. She said no, it was because the president did not respond, and the president proved to the meeting that she responded to her and said.
In her reaction, Ria Lidwaba described their removal as deliberately orchestrated.
The manner in which it was done in a manner that you could see that it was orchestrated. It was all done. It was just a formality in that meeting.
In Kenya, Gor Mahia, one of Kenya's most successful clubs, head coach Stephen Pollock is asking football stakeholders in the country to take a definite decision on the direction of the football league season in the country. The conclusion of the current KPL season has been thrown into doubt owing to the coronavirus that is ravaging the world. KPL, which was supposed to end on May 23rd, was suspended in March, with Gor Mahia sitting at the top with less than 10 rounds of matches to go.
I think they need to look at the big picture before they can make a big decision like that, because they say that the next season is supposed to start in August. So if we have to wait till the president, is it the 30th of June, to make a decision, then we'd have to train 4 or 5 weeks. So that takes you into August. So that means the season won't finish till September, October.
And that's it on Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a very good day. That's it for this Monday, June 22nd edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for starting your week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Barton in Washington, hoping that you will have a very good week.
Border Crossings, of America's Request Hour, brings you an hour of great music and an escape from the news headlines, which aren't too good every single day. Tune in at 1500 Universal to Border Crossings. Make your requests by calling 202-619-2077, and we'll forget about all of our troubles and enjoy an hour of great music. Tune us in, Border Crossings, on the Voice of America.